When the media machine breaks down and spews shit everywhere, who ya gonna call? Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Hello and welcome to Reality Exploit Roundtable, Episode 2. I'm Plato, and I'll be your host for this episode. Our topics today include advances in biometrics, the state steals Kim.com's money, tens of trillions is hidden in offshore tax havens, and 3D printed guns hit the maker scene. Our panelists are Hero White. You there, Hero?
Yes, I am.
Good to have you. Smuggler, are you there?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Voodoo, how about you?
Ready to rumble.
And Wise Guy? All right. Our first topic is going to be biometrics. Turns out that the biometric recognition group, ATVS, reported at the Black Hat conference that they've managed to spoof iris recognition systems. Wired reports that their algorithm takes between 100 to 200 iterations to produce an iris image that is sufficiently similar to one that the researchers are trying to reproduce. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes to produce an iris image that matches an iris code. He notes that about 20% of the iris codes are resistant to the attack. So we're ending up with a lot of security systems worldwide that are starting to rely on this iris recognition tech. And here comes this attack that makes it possible to pretend to be somebody else. And what concerns me is that it's going to be governments and big businesses who have control over all these biometric databases. If someone compromises one, that's identity theft times a million. What else could go wrong?
Oh, I think that biometrics in itself is the definition of things going wrong. I think it's one of the worst kinds of authentication and identification that you can have. I mean, you cannot change your iris pattern as you can change your password. You cannot change your face as you can change your password. You cannot change your fingerprints as your password. And the problem is, since you cannot change it as soon as it is broken, it's broken forever. So it's probably one of the worst ideas ever. And of course, the reason behind the idea is not security. The reason behind that idea is control. Governments wanting to control people.
Well, isn't that the point of an authentication system? You want to be able to know exactly who's entering and who's using your system. And the people who are using these biometric systems, I agree with you that their entire point, they want to be able to be in control of the entire system. From their point of view, that's a good thing. They say that if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Hero, what do you think?
Oh, well, I think it is about controlling the people, and it's about ultimately eliminating every form of what we may consider to be our own privacy and liberty that we have right now. So, I mean, once you get a system like this in, then you won't be able to you do a banking transaction without using your your biometric information. And once they have these systems in place and they say, oh, we're stopping fraud and all these type of things, then, and you crack down on alternate payment systems, then you have absolute control over everything and everyone, because you can't just cross a border, you can't do a transaction, you can't do at a bank or at paying for your food or anything like that without using their system, and their system is going to be biometric. Therefore, they're going to be able to track and know everything that you are doing. So it expands way beyond like crossing borders.
You know, Plato, what struck me in the Wired article was the fact that untrained observers could tell the fake iris. They only got fooled 35% of the time, where the technology, the actual iris scanners, were getting fooled 80% of the time. It just seems to me like another one of these in the long line of dowsing rods that governments and so-called security firms buy that don't actually work. The puffers at the airports, the nude scanners at the airports that don't work, the bomb sniffers that have been sent over to Iraq and Kuwait and different places that are nothing more than a little pack with an LED light on it. You know, they get hit into these silly technologies and that promise the world, but all they are is a dowsing rod.
Well, those technologies do really work, but they can be broken.
Yeah, they may work, and it seems to me that a big part of it isn't so much you know, increases in security, it's increases in perceived security. The whole point of all these, you know, scanners and puffers and sniffers at TSA checkpoints, it's not making us safer. You can go and Google TSA infographic and see exactly how useful it is. And hey, pro tip, it's not. But it makes some percentage of the American populace feel safe because somebody's doing something to protect us against these bad guys.
I think that's an excellent point. That's referred to a lot right now by security theater. And you can see that, like you brought up the scanners at the airports. When you look at who's behind these companies and the amount of money and contracts that are coming in, every time they come up with a new device that has some type of new technology and they can get these contracts for it and push them through. So on all of this, I think that you nailed on one of the most important factors in this, besides any type of control, ideas of control, which is related to this. But usually these things are being pushed through by companies that are getting huge contracts to do so.
Didn't one of Dick Cheney's companies manage to sell a bunch of TSA equipment?
It was Michael Chertoff's company, the first, wasn't he the first Homeland Security head?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that you've put your finger on the point that it's really the large industrial companies that are pushing these technologies for profit. And it's no secret that one of the points of inflection for monitoring populations occurred with the great support of American companies, the Chinese Olympics in Beijing. I think that we've gone from a situation where most people assume that if they weren't doing anything illegal, they weren't being spied upon, to a situation where we're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of in what we think of as free countries or countries with some liberty and social rights.
That segues into our second topic, which is the state stealing Kim.com's money. And in addition to these psychological control systems of, you know, safety in airports, there's a bunch of monetary control systems, and the courts are a large part of that. So if you're unfamiliar with Kim.com and the Mega Upload case, Kim.com operates Mega Upload and some other ventures, and he is trying to, the U.S. is trying to extradite him for a bunch of IP law violations. And they seized $67 million of his assets and are refusing to let him access that money. So he can't pay his lawyers and he can't, you know, buy plane tickets for everybody to get to the U.S. And he's offered, he's said, I'm willing to stand trial in the U.S. if you give me a fair trial and you unfreeze my funds. And the state is not willing to do that. And, you know, being Kim.com, he has some great sound bites. He says, the internet is uniting behind me. Everyone can see what's going on. Hollywood is in control of politics and has imported their action-filled movie scripts into the real world. My home was raided by 72 heavily armed police arriving in helicopters. This was an Osama bin Laden-style operation on an alleged copyright infringer. I guess it's pure luck that my family wasn't terminated by a predator drone. So, I think that Bitcoin is important to bring up here. I think it has the potential to be extremely disruptive, but so far it's tame. Hero, do you think that states are going to start actively interfering once people start using Bitcoin to hide their funds from those states?
Yes, I do, but I think that that's not really the problem that's at hand right now. First off, let me say that I think that Kim.com is an idiot. He holds the $67 million in nation-state bank accounts easily seizable by the U.S. government. He's flaunting his wealth like some opulent movie star. You can see these pictures of him all over the internet, living in a $30 million resort-like estate. You know, he's got this helicopter, $6 million in cars that they confiscated, and all the full well knowing that there's a global war on file sharing and P2P. It goes all the way back to the time of Napster and many other companies. There's a whole list everyone knows, and he's full aware of it. He's not some just business guy. He's a tech guy. He used to call himself some super hacker. So he knows what's going on. And so he was a target, and he knew it. But he thought he had enough cash and lawyers to keep himself safe. And then he wakes up one day and has his wee-wee caught in Uncle Sam's grinder. And we're supposed to think of him as some type of free speech martyr. Now, he should have had his for several points here. He should have had his wealth more distributed and not easily seizable. He should have used Bitcoin or a cryptocurrencies or digital cash as payment methods in the first place. And instead of having $6 million in cars, he should have had some holdings in Bitcoin. So he's broke right now. He played in their system, and he had this massive server farm. It was all centralized. So back to like in previous show, and you hear me talk about this all the time. A lot of the core of the problem here, you have to go back, is he was playing in the old big large corporate system. He was flaunting his wealth and his business and what he was doing at Hollywood and the U.S. government, and now we're supposed to have some type of sympathy for him. So back to his, now he released his video. In his video, he exposed his problem in the past and his problem right now, and that is, he says, Mr. President, the video was well done. So he's asking the bear that raided his picnic basket if he's going to fix the problem. So, if he would have run this with a decentralized file sharing system, sort of like a BitTorrent cyber locker system that was running over some type of a dark net and it was using its cryptocurrency, lived less of a opulent lifestyle, as I was saying, then he wouldn't be in this situation. And I think that if anyone is going to be doing any type of business where you are flaunting your wealth, and if anything about it is legally questionable, or if you have large corporate or government enemies that are coming against you, you should expect to lose everything in this climate. So that's how I feel about that.
So you think he's just fucked? You think there's no chance that he's going to get to come to the U.S. and have a fair trial and get his assets unseized and actually, make a fight and actually be a martyr?
Oh, I don't know. But, for one thing, he asked about on Twitter and some other places about alternate payment systems. And John Matonis and many other people replied to him, and a whole slew of replies to him about Bitcoin, Bitcoin, Bitcoin. He hasn't said anything about Bitcoin. If he hasn't said, here's my Bitcoin address, and this new, and he's already started up some new file sharing or some other type of business that he's planning on launching. He hasn't said it's going to be Bitcoin based or something like that. So, he could have. I know that he would get a slew of Bitcoin donations to him, but I don't know. Like I said, I'll back up. Is that, yeah, I kind of think that he may be a little screwed, but it's like Julian Assange. Is Julian Assange a little screwed? I don't know whether he's going to get through this or not, but I think that misses the point that Julian Assange should not have put himself out there as the lead. He shouldn't have had his money, his assets for the company be able to be seized, and his donations should have been, coming in another way. So I think that the problem goes way back, and it's bigger than just, people trying to fight for their rights right now.
I might tone in here that as far as having your money seized and being unable to represent yourself because you can't hire attorneys, a situation like this occurred probably 20 or 30 years ago in Las Vegas. Many of the gang kingpins owned pieces of hotels in Las Vegas, and of course there was skimming going on, all kinds of illegal activities. And in several of the cases, people like Meyer Lansky and Nikki Scarfo and all those others had their funds seized in their bank, so they couldn't hire an attorney. At that time, they were represented by Oscar Goodman, who's now the mayor of Las Vegas. And he went to court and convinced a federal judge that it was unconstitutional to prevent the funds from a person who had not been convicted of a crime from being seized and being unable to represent themselves when these funds were really the only means of hiring a good attorney. Since they hadn't been convicted yet, there's no reason those funds should be considered tainted.
Well, Wise Guy, you're displaying some awesome trust in the whole justice system here. I have to say that I don't share that trust at all, especially not when it comes to high-profile political cases. And whole Mega Upload case is more about politics than about law or justice. So I don't share your optimism here. On another note, Hiro said that he has little sympathy for this Kim guy. Yes, Kim.com is not the martyr of free speech. I mean, he used court cases to try to silence critics here in Germany. So he's not a free speech guy.
Well, to me, he seems like he's a little more than one of these rap stars, chains around his neck, and a driveway full of cars, living a very large lifestyle, and flaunting his wealth with really no tradecraft.
You're critiquing my lifestyle.
Oh, it's the one I aspire to also.
Yeah, great point, wise guy, about the tradecraft. Just a little bit of tradecraft, a little bit of protecting your assets. This guy just had it hanging out in the wind for anyone to take. I'm surprised it took a government to do it, and he didn't get taken by some sort of shyster or some sort of scammer. In the same situation, you have these medical marijuana dispensaries. They've got their stuff hanging out in the wind because they're trying to be all lawful and say, oh, we comply with all the laws and we pay all these taxes, and then we have all our money sitting in this bank where it's nice and easy to seize by the DEA when they decide that they have too much money in the bank. They know that they are targets. They have got to start using some sort of discretion. You wouldn't see, cartel members leaving their cheese hanging out the way Kim.com and these dispensaries do.
Well, it's not just the people who are actually selling or growing the drugs, the marijuana, that face criminal prosecutions. Recently in the Emerald Triangle up in Northern California, the county supervisors were threatened with prosecution if they passed resolutions that protected the growers in any way.
Well, it seems that the rule of law isn't necessarily working exactly as it's supposed to, and you'd be well suited to try and find different ways to protect your assets, whether that's storing them in bitcoins or buying silver, or perhaps putting your money in tax havens. Now, it seems tax havens are more, for the guys who are on the good side of the law, the guys at the very top who have, billions of dollars to try and hold on to instead of, one field worth of pot. But these tax havens exist. They have for a while. A recent report by James Henry and the Tax Justice Network, they ran the numbers and concluded that somewhere between $21 trillion and $32 trillion U.S. dollars is hidden in offshore accounts out of the reach of state taxmen. And interestingly, there's about 10 million people who have assets offshore, but half of that money is owned by 92,000 people. So it's very concentrated. And, I mean, I don't see this as a broken system. It was built this way on purpose. Haven't we really known for forever that elites can exploit offshore tax loopholes to pay less money? Wise guy, you used to work in banking, so what's your take on this?
Well, first, the most important reason given for reining in tax havens is to promote tax justice. Well, tax justice is a joke, in my opinion. One of the primary reasons for income taxes when they were created was to enable class warfare. So it's just the many against the few screaming when they're not getting the kind of ability to enable class warfare to their advantage that they'd like. Second, it's no coincidence that most offshore locations are former Brit colonies. When the European powers left their colonies after the Second World War, they replaced the formal controls over these ex-colonies with different arrangements to maintain a measure of control behind the scenes. The use of these jurisdictions as tax havens is a form of colonization by other means. It's really a replacement for their empire. The focus by the lamestream media on the wealthy avoiding taxes in offshore locations, in my opinion, is a false flag for what's really happening. The so-called tax havens aren't just to hide taxes. More often, they're also to hide political and intelligence agency slush funds. And I have two examples. One is the Nguyen Han Bank, spelled N-U-G-A-N, which was a merchant bank in Australia that collapsed in a sensational circumstance in about 1980 amidst rumors of involvement by the Central Intelligence Agency in organized crime. Authors Alfred McCoy and Sterling and Peggy Seagrave claimed that the Union Hand Bank was totally CIA-controlled, and they saw it as a part of a series of CIA-controlled banks, preceded by Castle Bank and Trust, and succeeded by the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI. And now, BCCI was very interesting because it held accounts by former U.S. Commissioner of Customs, and Oliver North used it, and it was used by the CIA in order to funnel Iran-Contra money, and also for Afghanistan to help the freedom fighters there, as so-called. Now, the U.S. intelligence agencies not only did stuff like that, but they were using it to overthrow governments or destabilize governments. Now, on a more personal note, one of my friends was given deep access to BCCI financials due to his being retained by a powerful individual prior to possibly investing in BCCI. What he discovered, completely by accident, were accounts corresponding to those of the U.S. Treasury's Fedwire system. And the reason he knew that is he had worked as a consultant on Fedwire, so he could recognize those account numbers. Somebody else that had not been in that would have never realized it.
Wise guy, what's Fedwire?
That's the system that's used to move money between banks in the United States. Most all of the money moved in the United States between banks goes through the Fedwire. So you need to look no further than these agencies to realize why it's been so difficult to rein in these tax havens and errant banks, because it's not just about the taxes. It's about power and money all over the world in our largest countries.
That's remarkable. This Nugan Hand Bank kind of reminds me of AIG. AIG and shady dealings with a subsidiary called Kroll around the time of 9/11. And then they explode in 2008. No one got in trouble. No one found out what happened to all these accounts. I wonder exactly how much of this sketchy shit is going on involving government agencies and banks worldwide. It's got to be way more than we expect.
Well, I think the rabbit hole goes right to the bottom.
The Tax Justice Network, they released this report saying that these trillions of dollars are locked in offshore havens. They don't really know for sure. That's a guess on their part. What's interesting how they released the report, though, is they gave it to The Guardian, and then they gave it to the BBC, but they didn't make the report publicly available so that if they found any critics, then they could release the data selectively just to counter any critics that they got. Meanwhile, nobody can look at their actual calculations and see what they're doing. But for a while, they had at least the appendices of the report up on their website, the Tax Justice website. And what was neat in Appendix 2, they were talking about the reasons for this offshoring and saying, well, there's a lot of microeconomic reasons that are given. We don't think those are true. We think this is more macroeconomic. And then, of course, they proceed to give a microeconomic explanation for it. But their explanation is basically in these third world countries in the 70s and 80s, there was a push to provide investment dollars, buy these government bonds. That did a couple of things. It made these governments flush with cash, but then it also opened up banking pipelines into these countries. And of course, the pipelines work both ways. Cash goes in, cash goes out. Through corruption in the government and then some sweetheart contracts with selected people, all of this money that got loaned to these third world countries got concentrated in a few hands, and they proceeded to immediately move the money out of these countries. Tax Justice, of course, has a problem that the money wasn't used in the first place to build the tax base, which, whatever you believe on that. My take on it, though, is if to the extent that the Tax Justice Network is right about, at least in the third world countries, how the money was borrowed and left, that's stolen money. This is money that the taxpayers of these countries are going to have to pay back on these loans, on these government loans. That is stolen money. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for the folks who have that money offshore in these tax havens. But I also don't have sympathy for Tax Justice Network, because the last people I want to have that money would be the governments. These, especially the third world governments, they're very good at subjugating their people and oppressing their people, and they don't need that money to do more. And there's no evidence that the corruption stopped. There's no evidence that if the money were repatriated, that it wouldn't end up right back in the hands of a few crony capitalists. So there's not a lot of sympathy for me on either side of that argument.
Well, if the rabbit hole does go all the way down and it's really as shady as we're suspecting it may be, maybe it's the case that Tax Justice Network is just trying to cover their own ass and not release information that's going to, you know, get them in some severe trouble. Who knows? I certainly don't.
Well,
Let's move on. Wise guy, all right, go ahead. You can have the final word here.
Well, Jim Davidson has written about Somalia and what's been going on behind the scenes, and I think they are a poster child for how governments run up these huge debts internationally, and then leave the common people to repay them after the people who ran the governments were driving around in their expensive cars and building their palaces. So what's going on in Somalia is sort of a good indication is that you've got the central government that the UN and the issues of trying to impose on the country for their good, of course. But then you've got these tribal people who are rejecting the government and don't want a central government. And one of the reasons they don't want it is that if there's no central government, then international laws can't apply because there's no nation state. And therefore, the money doesn't have to be paid back because there's no way of collecting it because the international laws don't apply.
Tax justice is just another synonym for everyone being equally robbed. Thank you.
All right, we'll move on to our final topic for this episode, which is 3D printed guns. On the AR15.com forums, we spotted a thread where user HavBlue has successfully printed an AR-15 lower receiver on a 3D printer from the 1990s. And I'm not really a gun nut, but I'm aware that particular part of the AR-15 is heavily regulated, and it's hard to get a hold of. And if you can just print it in your backyard, then, you know, a lot more people are going to be able to arm themselves. So I had an interesting discussion a couple weeks ago with one of my friends about the AK-47. He argued that its net benefit to humanity outweighs its net cost, which sounds weird. But it kind of makes sense, because before the AK-47, you got these victimized groups, and they're fighting their oppressors with rifles and handguns and sticks and stones, and then this mass-produced gun comes along, the Kalashnikov. It's cheap, reliable, and it's deadly, which is exactly what you need if you're a little guy trying to stand up to a big guy. It's a force equalizer. So on the one hand, you do have millions of people who are killed by AK-47s, but on the other, there's some unknown number of people who would have been subjugated or would be dead if they hadn't had those AK-47s to defend themselves. So, Voodoo, do you think tech like 3D printed guns, drones, is going to be enough to keep today's oppressors from killing tomorrow's victims?
Absolutely not. That boat sailed a long time ago. These governments can conjure money out of thin air. They can always find a way to score more weapons. Look at the problem, if you believe the reports, these rebels in Syria are having just to get rid of the Assad regime, and they've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them. There's no way to stop oppression by violence, government oppression by violence. The only way to do it is counter economics. Subvert the state by draining its resources off, by draining the tax base or weakening the tax base by sending by using the resources and eventually just making the state wither away because it's completely irrelevant. We've replaced those institutions with counter-economic institutions. We've replaced the monetary system with real money that people have faith in. We've replaced these crony capitalist banks with real 100% reserve banks where people can store their money and feel safe about it.
I'm not sure that the counter-economics are so easy, not that anyone thinks that they are, but because of the economic policies that have been followed in most countries, most of the people are actually become wards of the state. they're really dependent largely or wholly on the state for money. So anyone who runs counter-economics will find it exceedingly difficult to attract people into that realm, because they and their neighbors are going to rat you out, just like you had in the Soviet Union and Stasi Germany, because you're threatening their ability to even survive if you eliminate the tax base or hurt it significantly.
Which brings you back to Treadcraft, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. But wise guy, that same point can go right back to Plato's question with the 3D printing tech distributed drone technologies, whether that can stop oppressors. The horizontal enforcement is really what keeps the keeps states in power. It's the states themselves, they don't have enough people to subjugate an entire population of even a small country. What it is the horizontal enforcement of your neighbor ratting you out telling the authorities, quote unquote, what you're doing.
I think there's a couple other angles in here that are interesting. To me, if you're able to print your own weapon and you're living in a country which has banned weapons, and it's difficult for you to get a hold of some type of a gun that you may be interested in using for home defense, defending your family, whether it's concealed carry or just something you keep in your house and on your property, and whether that's legal or illegal, all around the world, people still have them. And if you can print one of these out, then the ability for individuals to be able to use these things, and not just against an oppressive government, but for self-defense, I think is an interesting and a fantastic thing for people who have been forcibly disarmed. I think the other thing that is interesting is that I haven't been able to see the details of this and understand the implications of the technology that was achieved, is if we're starting to print things like this, if you can print, let's just say you could print out a gun, a full working gun. If you could do that, then I think the engineering applications of that far exceed any type of just focusing on, oh, wow, now I can print a gun. Well, if you can print out a gun, can you print out, like we talked about in one of the other shows, can you print out an engine? Can you print out other engineering devices that can be used to help you grow your own food, to help you become more of a resilient and self-sufficient outside of centralized power distribution, centralized communication systems, and all of these things? So I think that's the more interesting part of them printing this gun.
And let's be clear, what he printed was the lower. The barrel and the receiver, he didn't print any of that, because that has to contain the kerblam, and no 3D printing is up to that standards. It would just explode from the pressure.
Disagree. There have been complete guns built with 3D printing, complete guns, not just receivers.
Well, the one that Plato brought up was just the lower that he printed. The turning a rifled barrel is still an artist's job. Not just anyone can do that. They're not going to be able to do that with 3D printing. They're not going to be able to do that on their home lathe. That's something that requires serious manufacturing capability to be able to turn a rifled barrel.
Links to complete gun manufacturer on 3D printing can be found in the show notes later. But the interesting part is that the same technology, printing out gun parts, has been used by the U.S. Army for quite a few years in Iraq. So essentially, what you have is containers, shipping containers with all the 3D printing technology in there, and military personnel being able to get replacement parts on the spot, have them printed out, have them modified. So you have a much a shorter innovation cycle in the whole process. So there has been some very good experience with that by the U.S. Army.
I think that the projectiles were replaced instead of with a standard firearm, a bullet casing type of system, something that it was a small rocket, then the pressure requirements inside the casing are tremendously relaxed. There was someone who produced a firearm that did fire small rocket projectiles, perhaps in the 1970s or 1980s. And I'm sure if someone were to reapply their thinking to that, they could come up with inexpensive ways to manufacture small rocket-propelled devices. So you didn't have this requirement for exotic materials or metal on lathes.
Well, some of this is pretty depressing, but I really like the idea of printing other stuff other than weapons, you know, for building instead of destroying. And it reminded me of this project that I heard of called Open Source Ecology, the Global Village Construction Set. And this is a set of open source blueprints. I'm not sure if they've completed this yet, but everything from backhoes to brick ovens to 3D printers, the idea is to be able to just give you a torrent that contains all the plans and all the parts lists and everything you need to build a complete society from the ground up. And see, that's an awesome project. These guys don't take Bitcoins yet. I don't know if they've heard of them. I'm looking at their donate page. But check out opensourceecology.org. Send them a message and tell them that Bitcoins is a technology that really ties in well with this idea of, you know, free culture. And I guess I'll call that my plug, and we're running up on time, so I'm going to wrap this up. The rest of our panelists, I'll give you all a chance to plug projects, blogs, whatever you find interesting. So, Smuggler, you got any URLs, anything that our listeners should check out?
No, but I think everyone here should work on world peace and undomination.
That's a fantastic idea. World peace and global domination. Hero, how about you?
No, just check out our other shows on Agorist Radio. We're starting up some of the Cypherpunk again, Coinbase, and Agorist Social Club. That's all for me.
Awesome. Wise guy, you got anything?
Yeah, I'll have a link where people can download an ebook copy of Nicholas Shackson's Treasure Islands ebook. And I think that book is probably has the most detail of anyone that I found as to what's going on in the offshore world and how the rabbit hole goes right to the bottom.
That sounds fantastic. How about you, Voodoo?
Sure, anyone can come to blackandyellowpages.com, a agorist business directory, and if you want to see some of the machine work I've been doing, you can check out beercanengines.info.
Awesome, guys. That'll wrap up our show. This is episode 2 of Reality Exploit Roundtable. Our episodes are hosted by Hero at agoristradio.com, and you can find our up-to-date show notes with contact info and references at github.com/agoristradio. Look for the Reality Exploit Roundtable repo. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week.